I had my children on the floor. I was on my favourite blanket that my grandmother gave me on the floor like a cat.
And I realised in that moment the potential of what our bodies can really do as women.
Like, I could feel his head. I could do my own internal, like, yeah, his head, I could feel it.
I was in tears. I was just in tears and overwhelmed with gratitude.
Hi, and welcome to the Natural Birth Podcast, the podcast that is bringing embodied birth wisdom from women from all over the world sharing their natural birth stories. Don't forget to subscribe and download so that you can always have access to these empowering and positive natural birth stories.
Hi, my name is Anna, and I am the Natural Birth Podcast host. I'm a former midwife turned midwitch, and I now work with women worldwide, assisting them in having an empowering and natural birth experience and to truly claim their birth as a rite of passage. I offer one-on-one sessions and packages and online courses for conscious mamas who don't want to leave their birth up to chance. I also mentor current and aspiring birth workers in my Sacred Birth Worker Mentorship Program. If you want to know more about me and what I do in the world, then please visit me at thenaturalbirthcourse.com or connect with me on Instagram as The Natural Birth Podcast. Now, if you love this podcast, then please consider taking a moment right now and leave a review. They mean the world to me and is also your way of helping me reach more women around the world with these natural and empowering birth stories. Together, we are changing the birth narrative, one birth story at a time. Today on the Natural Birth Podcast, we have Mei Yoshikawa. Mei is a mama of two from Japan. She is an author and yoga meditation teacher, as well as a global ambassador for Adidas. She has been on 42 consecutive covers of the Japanese Yogini magazine and was awarded the Yoga Journal People's Award in 2016. Her offerings have been featured on many media outlets, including Vogue Japan, GQ, and Women's Health. Today, she is here to share about her two natural births in Japan. With her first, she had a natural birth in a birthing center. It went smoothly with no medications, but it was very painful, which Mei puts down to not truly being prepared mentally and not really allowing birth to unfold. 8 years later, having learned from this experience, she had a beautiful home water birth that she says was almost all pain-free. She was supported by her midwife and late husband, and she felt like it was a communion of souls, and it was a very empowering experience. Curious about Mei? Find her on Instagram as Mei Yoshikawa. Now, I hope you've had a beautiful and restful few weeks over Christmas and New Year's. I've had one of the loveliest Christmases and New Year's in a long time. Lots and lots of family time and good food and fun, as well as days of rest and quiet. I've had time to catch up with friends, and I've been creative with visioning and pottery. I danced in the New Year's at a Five Rhythms Dance Weekend workshop before celebrating the New Year's with family at a restaurant overlooking the whole of the capital city of Sweden. It has been glorious. And I don't know about you, but I truly feel that January is a slow, introverted, retrospective, like in-between month. The new year hasn't really started. We are still in that in-between, calm before the storm, everything gets going, feeling, I feel. I really feel that it's February that the new year's really happen. And this month, I'm in deep weaving of a new offering. And I'll soon announce more. It's still in its seed form and in the dreaming, but it's ready to sprout any day now. Until I announce it, I want to offer you another thing. I want to offer you a place inside my exclusive, private, uncensored sisterhood community, The Village. This month will be the last month that I offer a free trial month. From February on, this will end. If you love this podcast, I think you will love being a part of my village. Many of the podcast guests end up hanging out in there, and it's a really close-knit community that eagerly embraces new sisters as they come in. Come and join us this week and join our monthly village sharing circle on Wednesday. There are two times available to suit everyone around the world. Come sit in sacred space with me, share, and have a chance to ask all your questions about fertility and conception, pregnancy, birth, postpartum, baby care, breastfeeding, healing of the mother, and so much more. And this month, and this month only, you can join for free to check it out and feel it out. Find the link to The Village in the show notes. Welcome, sister, into my own little village. Hi, May, and welcome to the Natural Birth Podcast. How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks for connecting with me here in Tokyo, all the way across the world. It's so lovely to speak with you.
It's so lovely to have you. As we kind of mentioned briefly before starting recording, there's one other story of all the stories the last 3 years that took place in Japan. And so I'm very curious to hear your stories and how it was to birth there. I love that this podcast has so many different stories from around the world, different cultural ways of birthing, or maybe approaching pregnancy, postpartum. And it's just so rich for women to hear and like be inspired from women from around the world. So thank you for coming on and wanting to share your stories with us.
It's my joy.
Beautiful. Well, let's dive on back to, you know, becoming pregnant. Was that a planned pregnancy, your first one? And how did you approach pregnancy and birth the first time around?
You know, so I've had two pregnancies and I have two boys and different fathers. So my first marriage in my mid-20s, a lot of my background is in yoga and meditation. I spent some 13 years keeping a house in South India where I was furthering my practice there. So by my first pregnancy, I had already been practicing like intense, rigorous, very physically like athletic style of yoga for some 7 years. I was very physically fit. And a couple years into my marriage, I know that I really wanted the baby. And my first husband, he said that he wanted whatever I wanted, which at the time I thought was nice. You know, I thought it was romantic. And as my pregnancy progressed, though, I was obviously very involved with the pregnancy, and it was a first time for everything. I was eager to learn. But he wasn't very involved. Like, he didn't come to the checkups with me. And so he was there at my very first pregnancy checkup. And then he was also there at the birth because I asked him to be. But he didn't come to any of the checkups in between. And then, of course, pretty shortly after my first birth, we separated. And then we divorced and went our separate ways. So I really didn't know it then. But at the time, I think there was a sense of a disconnect, you know, not so much with me and my body, but within sort of the familial structure, and a sense of safety and relaxation that I later learned through my second marriage and my second birth that was so essential to this birthing process.
Love that insight. So do you want to talk us through the first birth? Like, did you have any early signs of labor approaching for you? Where did you decide to birth and with whom?
Right. So for my first birth, I was in the southwestern region of Japan in the city of Fukuoka. And like I said, I was heavily into yoga. So I was very much in tune with my body and with the breath. But again, in hindsight, it was still a lot of masculine energy. It was still a lot of go, 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 push things through. And I hadn't really learned to relax completely. Early on in the pregnancy, when I went to the first clinic to confirm my pregnancy, I had this kind of like middle-aged older man, Japanese man, who was the doctor. And in Japan, they issue these mother-child, they call it boshitecho. It's a mother-child handbook that they issue to confirm your pregnancy. And you keep a record of your state during pregnancy. And you also keep a record of the baby, like in its early months and years. And these handbooks are issued according to where you birth. So whichever prefecture and municipality you birth in. So my doctor said, well, Mei-san, you're not from Fukuoka, you're from Tokyo. So if you're going to consider birthing, you know, back in Tokyo where you're from, then you should get your handbook issued there. Like you shouldn't get the Fukuoka version. And that was kind of the first initiation into, oh, where am I going to birth? And what kind of a birth do I want? And I got to thinking, you know, a lot of women that I had heard from, they choose their birthing place as if they're choosing a grocery store, you know, like what's the closest, what's the most convenient, and what's within reach, maybe what's affordable and all of these things. They're not bad ideas. But I was like, this is my baby, you know, and if he's going to be birthed into the world, I want to know whose hand it is that's going to touch his head first. So I wanted to pick the person to birth with rather than the place. So I searched midwives, and I also did a little bit of research into home births. But my first doctor, when I mentioned the word home birth, he was like appalled. You know, he was like, have you seen the statistics around home birthing and how risky it is and how 10% of the women, all of the risks happen in the final hour of labor and all of these things. And I was in my 20s, I was very fit, and I felt very in touch with my body. And I said, well, I understand the statistics, but how do you determine whether I land in the 90% or whether I land in the 10%? And he was kind of like, well, this is the statistics. So whichever you land in is just, you know, we'll find out sort of thing. But I felt confident that it was a low-risk pregnancy for me. My mother and my sisters, like, they haven't had any issues. I just didn't feel like there would be medical issues for me. So I could tell that I really wasn't vibing with this doctor. So I actually never went back to him. And I did look into home birthing, but the midwife that I wanted to birth with, she was the 72-year-old grandma at the time. And she had birthed like thousands of babies. And I felt this very gentle kind of maternal energy about her. And I read her book and I loved her philosophy. So I thought I wanted to birth with her. I had this dream of taking up the baby with my own hand. And I thought, but if something happens and I can't take the baby with my own hand, then let it be her hand, right? That carries the baby into this world. But she was quite old and late in her career, and she wasn't doing home births anymore. So she said, if you want to birth with me, then you come to my birthing center. It was about an hour away from my house at the time, but I decided to birth at her birthing center.
Beautiful. Yeah. I love that. I'm curious about that statistic that doctor quoted, because I've never heard such a thing. And all the research is showing that, you know, home birth is as safe when it comes to mortality, morbidity for mom and bub, and it's so much safer for a woman who is, you know, a normal pregnancy, normal, healthy woman. So that's curious. I would want that statistic sent to me.
Right. Well, and this is 14 years ago, right? Because my first son is now 14. Mm. And, you know, there were so many things that I didn't know, even though I was very much in touch with my body and doing this practice of yoga and breathing and all of that. There was so much of an internal sense of like letting go and releasing and allowing and opening up and these things that I hadn't yet experientially like made my own in my body. So I mean, as I look back on it, there were so many things that I wish that even my midwife could have taught me better in terms of the way that I could have relaxed and released more and things. She taught me like more kind of general things about how you can birth the baby with your heart wide open and stuff. Mm. But it just didn't really land with me. You know, I wasn't really taught how to breathe or how to relax my jaw or, you know, the way that I might move freely. So these things all played a role as I approached my birth, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is. It's just for all women almost around the world, as you fall pregnant, it's all new and you don't know.
Yes.
And there's a lot to learn. And it's also like you can't learn everything, like, as well. You know, it's like you learn what you need to learn, I guess, for that birth and what you need to go through that first birth to learn for the next or for life or for being that mother for that child. And
yeah,
everything has its meaning somehow as well.
Yeah. So for me, I was a vegetarian at the time and heavily into yoga. I was doing a lot of reading to prepare myself for a natural birth. And I did read stories about orgasmic births and pain-free births, but somehow they felt remote. They felt like it would be some faraway fairy tale. It just didn't sound like anything in my world. Because when I was a teenager and I got my first period, and my mom was like, well, congratulations, you know, one day you can have babies now. She also said to me that contractions would be very, very painful. And my mom is a mother of four kids. I'm the last of four siblings in our family. And my mom, she said, you know, when you get your contractions and it hurts very much, wait for it to hurt 100 times more before you go to the hospital. And this is kind of embedded in my subconscious. I hadn't thought about it in years, but again, I couldn't shake off this idea that birthing would be wonderful, but that it would be one of the most painful things that I would experience in my lifetime was kind of this vague idea that I thought, but it's just like, it's kind of crazy because again, these things are like subconsciously embedded. Mm-hmm. And you know, in the movies that we see in the TV series and those hospital gurneys with women screaming their heads off and these images, you know? So yeah, when I heard about orgasmic births and pain-free births, it just didn't sound real. So when my turn came with my first, it was 40 weeks and 2 days. And I got my contractions.
Did they just come on? Did you just come on and you birthed the baby? Or did you have any kind of early signs before you got that first contraction?
Well, they just settled in. But they settled in I felt it in the front side of my body, in the front side of my belly. And they were quite sharp and kind of, they were short in span, but it wasn't really down in my sacrum. It was forward in my belly. And I was afraid that it started at about maybe 5 or 6 p.m. And I was afraid that the baby would come in the middle of the night and that I would have to wake up my 72-year-old grandma midwife. So I called her up early. I called her at like 6 p.m. and I said, I'm feeling these contractions in my belly and I might have to visit you in the middle of the night. And she said, okay, well, please relax and see how it progresses. And if you need to, then you come on over. But I had this idea in my head that I would do everything that I read about in all of the pregnancy books that I studied, which included moving, like yoga, bathing, and all of these things. But I had also read about the Japanese women in the olden days who would take rags and clean the floor and the wooden pillars in their house on, like, clean the floor on all fours and the pillars in a vertical squatting motion, right, to give them this motion in the pelvic region, and how they would also cook extra food to keep in the freezer or to keep for the siblings and the other family members before they go into labor. So I thought, okay, well, great. I'm just going to outdo all of these Showa women. So I did all of that. I did all of the yoga, all of the cleaning, all of the cooking. And then I went for a walk. I came back and I was like, okay, maybe we can go on to the birthing center.
What time are we talking about then? So, because you said this was 5 or 6 p.m. at night. So you were up all evening doing all these things. And at one point, yeah. Did you think you were ready to go to the birth center?
Yeah, finally at like, and then I also took a bath and laid down and took a rest and all of these things too. And then finally at 2 a.m., I thought, okay, this is enough. Like, this is painful enough. And by then also, I was kind of howling through the intense contractions. I was keeping a towel like in my mouth to clench on. And we took the drive about an hour to the birthing center. My midwife examined me and she said, oh, you're not softening at all. You're not open at all. What have you been doing in those hours since you called me? So I was all like, well, I took a walk and then I cooked and then I cleaned and I took a bath and then I did all of these things. And she just kind of let out this sigh and she was like, oh, wow. Perhaps for some women, all of these motions would be good. But for you, no. You need to go home, lie down and rest. Sleep would be the best thing for you. And she later told me that she didn't expect me to come back for another couple of days at least, because she didn't think that I was opening at all. But in fact, once I went home, and I was in shock to go home too, because I thought this was enough pain and I thought I had gone through enough. And then I was like, oh my God, is my mom right? Was she right? You know, to have to endure these contractions so much. But once I got home, I took her advice and I lay down to rest. And I still had that towel that I was clenching on, but all of the hormones got to work in my body and I could actually fall asleep between the waves of contractions. And when that started to happen, it really helped me to open up very, very quickly. Until maybe 11 a.m., like noonish, the following day, I was like, okay, I don't think I can hold this any longer. Let's go again. So we went to the birthing center. And by then, I remember in the car, every red light, I was like, okay, we need to go, because I felt like I was going to have the baby in the car. But we made it to the birthing center. I had to walk myself upstairs because the labor room was upstairs.
This episode is sponsored by Informed Pregnancy Plus, a brand new pregnancy, birth, and postpartum streaming platform packed with informative and entertaining video content. Among their comprehensive and growing list of movies, you can watch iconic films like Ricky Lake's amazing documentary, The Business of Being Born, and the juicy and empowering documentary, Orgasmic Birth. The mind and body section includes meditations, yoga classes, fitness workouts, and belly dance for birth, all included within the subscription. You find workshops and book reviews and TV-style series on topics from fertility to breastfeeding and everything in between. I highly recommend this streaming platform to all my clients, as well as my mentees in my mentorship program, because there are brilliant resources in there. And the best news is that you can try Informed Pregnancy Plus absolutely free of charge. Just visit Informed Pregnancy TV and start streaming today.
And I went on the birthing table at first, again, because I had read that 80% of women prefer that position, to be on all fours to let the baby out. So I had spent some time like on all fours. But after a certain point, it wasn't progressing. And my midwife said, I think you need to turn around. So then I shifted onto the birthing chair where my legs were up in stirrups. And then immediately he started to transition. His head came down into my birthing canal. But as they say, of course, this is the most painful part of labor, they often say, right? For your first birth, when the head is just coming into the birth canal. And oh my God, like I screamed my head off. And I said in Japanese, Yamete! I was like, stop! Because I just couldn't take the physical pain anymore. I just wanted to like push the pause button, rewind to the part before I got pregnant and pretend all of this like never happened, you know? But of course, I'm at the birthing center in the labor room on the birthing chair. And the instant after I was done yelling, Yamete, there's this like, this release, because I had no more fight left in me. And as soon as my fight was released, my unintentional fight was released, and then the baby was born. So with the first, I had no pushing, like there was no pushing involved whatsoever. It was just my having released my resistance. And then the baby was born.
Wow.
Yeah.
So when you came in, you started going to the birthing center around 11. Did you just come in and birth the baby? Were you there for a while before you birthed the baby?
It took only like less than an hour. I was only there for 50 minutes the second time before the baby was born.
Wow.
Yeah.
What an interesting story. And I could feel very much just as your midwife said when you said that you started doing all those things at night. I was like, no. no, go right. to bed. Right. I think that's one of the biggest gems in your story for anyone who's listening. Like, especially if you're going into the night, like rest if you can, right? In those early hours. If you're during the day, then go about your day. But it's really that relaxation is so important, isn't it? Mm.
Yeah, there's this imbalance, not just in me, I don't think, but in a lot of the modern day world towards this do, accomplish, like get things done, you know, be on time, kind of a hurriedness to it. That's a very masculine energy. You'll soon hear in my second birth how I really, really learned from the first time. But the thing is, though, that at the time, I didn't know any better.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't in touch with that aspect of myself that would be ready and willing to allow and to let go so completely. Because I think at the end of the day, bottom line, I was probably a little scared. I was still a little scared, right? I had all of these stories of how painful birthing would be. I hadn't heard, seen, or met any woman that's had a joyous, exhilarating birthing experience, you know? So I had kind of an aftermath of that birth where I felt physically and emotionally torn apart. Something in me deeply said, well, wait, it wasn't supposed to be like that. Mm. You know, like I had this idea in my head, like, you know, God didn't design women and birthing to be like this ripping apart, this tearing apart from the core that just happened. Mm. It's like, there's got to be something that I was missing. But of course, in the postpartum days, then I'm newly trying to nurse this baby as I needed to let my body and everything recover and rejuvenate. And then starts this new life with this new being in your home, right? So, and then in my case, of course, within like 6 months after that, things just really took a 180 with my husband at the time. So the first few years were quite challenging. And as I became a single mom to my first son, I never knew if I would have a second because I was a single mom. I didn't have a partner. But I had this idea in the back of my head that if I ever get another chance at this, that I would do it a lot better the next time.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Now we kind of skip the postpartum part a little bit there, but after you birth your baby, is there any special way of you birth the placenta, and then is there any tradition in Japan around what to do with the placenta?
It's up to you. I think if you were to birth in a medical hospital, then they just treat it like any other hazardous bio waste sort of a thing.
Yeah.
But because I got to birth in the birthing center, and this lady, my midwife, had been working out of her birthing center for decades. And just about a 10-minute walk from her birthing center was the Munakata Shrine. And they had a small crematorium there. So we took she arranged to have my placenta cremated there.
Wow.
So there was definitely a very respectful sense of sacredness to the way that it was treated. That part was really lovely because it felt like the placenta had nourished us for all those months.
I love that. And what do you do after it's cremated?
After it's cremated, I think they give you like some kind of a symbolic ohuda, like a symbol to take home. And which I kept with the little piece of the umbilical cord that we had saved, in the box.
That's beautiful. And is the rest kind of scattered somewhere special or buried? Or
I believe it's buried with the trees in the shrine.
Oh, I love that. That is so beautiful. I love traditions that honor the placenta. It just feels every cell of my being just vibrates with the truth of that. It just feels so wholesome, so aligned, so true, so healing for, I feel, families, for communities, for the earth, for humanity. I just love that. That's so precious.
Wow. I think that's the first time anybody's ever asked me. You know, it took me a second to remember, how did we handle that? You know, that's amazing because, well, especially with the first, I was so overly focused on the pregnancy and the birth that I had no idea what to expect in those postpartum weeks and months. No one had really educated me about it. And even with what to do with the placenta, you know, I was fortunate that the midwife had a procedure that she honored. But I certainly was not in a place of conscious choice.
Yeah.
You know, I just didn't have all the information and I didn't even have the awareness to make those choices for myself.
Yeah. And so do I understand you right then that your postpartum weeks after, were they kind of like the normal Western society of just not much support or traditions? Or did you have some of that Japanese way in the postpartum from your midwife or from your family or society?
Yeah. So in Japan, they commonly say "sangu no tokuage sanshukan," which apparently is a phrase that refers to how the women who just birth, it's recommended that she lay down and stay in bed-ish for roughly 3 weeks to not have this gravitational pressure on the pelvic region to help her to heal after the birth. And so this is it's an olden day Japanese phrase that recommends that you don't fold your futon mattress for 3 weeks. Now, ordinarily, people would fold it every morning after they wake up. But in the case of the newly birthed woman, that you lay her futon mattress and you keep it there for 3 weeks is the saying. But for me, I was living away from my sisters, and my mother had been ill for many years at the time. So I didn't really have a network or a support system to fall back on. And that was really hard because I don't think my husband, like I said, he wasn't very involved. My sister came for a couple weeks, she came down from Tokyo for a couple weeks. And then I had another friend who also visited for 5 or 6 days and had them stay in the house, and they would help, you know, cook food or whatever was necessary. But I did feel this pressure, probably from my own self more than anything, to get up and start working again, you know, working like as I'm cooking and cleaning and doing the laundry and, you know, all of these domestic things that women are supposed to do, I guess.
Yeah, I hear you. So you divorced your husband, years went by, and you met a new man and you began
yes.
again. Do you want to talk us through that story?
Yeah. So in my mid 30s, I met a lovely man and we had a beautiful organic kind of development of a relationship where we started a relationship, but he also got to know my son and we came together as a family. We wanted to live together and then we decided that we wanted another baby. Once we decided that we wanted one, it was very easy. I conceived very easily. My second husband, there were so many things that was different. He was quite intuitive and quite in tune with himself, but also with me, like the vibe of the household. So he was very involved in my pregnancy. He wanted to come with me to every single checkup, you know, not just to be in touch with the baby, but to cover all the bills and the finances and to be involved in the decision-making process and all of these things. So I felt much more relaxed and protected and just held. I felt held, emotionally held through the whole process of it, not just bits and pieces or not just role playing, but he was really there because he was fully present and he wanted to be there. Well, I was at the time and I still am running a small business. So when it came time to decide where and with whom to birth the second baby, I did a lot of research and thinking around different risks. And I thought at the time that our best bet would be for me to birth at this clinic, a local, pretty popular clinic whose slogan it was to have a natural birth in a safe environment, meaning they advocate for natural vaginal births, but in case something goes wrong, then they have all of the medical facilities available. And I thought, okay, now between my small business and my new husband and my son, you know, that just in case something goes wrong, maybe this would be the suitable place for us. So I started going there. And, you know, I'm generally a happy person, but during pregnancy, I mean, I love being pregnant. I mean, I know that it can be very challenging for some people, but for me, there's such almost like this animalistic nature about how keen my nose would be and how I would know specifically what I want to eat or what I want to smell and who I want to hang out with and who not to and what to wear and what to feel on my skin and, you know, almost to a picky degree. So every day of my pregnancy, I was just like this joyous, ever-growing, evolving being. And then on these clinic checkup days, I would dip a little. I would just not vibe quite as high. And then as soon as I was out of the clinic, I'll feel better. And I just didn't let myself take it too seriously. I was like, okay, well, it is what it is. I'm healthy. The baby's healthy. I'm super fit. I thought everything was going to be okay. And then midway through my pregnancy, I wanted to take a trip to India as I had been doing every year. And I like to spend my pregnancies in India too, because it's very relaxing for me and I dive into my yoga practice and stuff. But the clinic had these really specific regulations around how many weeks between each checkup. But I wanted to stay in India for longer than a month. So I scooted one checkup forward. And I scooted one checkup backward to get in like a month and a half of a stay in India. And I was so relaxed and I felt so in tune with myself. And there was really no reason to worry about my pregnancy. And then the first checkup after I came home from India, and of course, my husband's coming with me to the checkup, the nurse was like scrutinizing my test results and my, you know, all of the numbers and my weight and everything, all of which was fine. There was like nothing was risky about all of the test results. In fact, there was nothing to point out, but there was so nothing to point out that finally she said, your weight is 2 pounds over the bell curve.
Oh my God.
And I know, right? So there I am, 27 weeks pregnant and hormonal. And then I said, well, what risk could 2 pounds possibly pose for the baby and for me? I mean, clearly I'm very fit. And she goes, we advocate for natural vaginal birth. And as you know, like, this is what you want too. But if your vaginal walls collect too much fat, this might be more difficult, like for the baby.
Oh my fucking God, this is bullshit. And you know what? For anyone listening, because I actually think this is so important to know, like, there is this new book out by Sarah Wickham where she really talks about the evidence and the lack thereof of actually women who are bigger and even obese, that there's actually no like massive greater risk. And even to say so, it's 2 pounds. Oh my goodness. Like, no, your vagina will not be too fat to birth. Like, stop it.
So I had a whole like snappy narrative going off in my mind. Like, I just wanted to snap back and be like, you know, lady, who do you think you're talking to? Like, I've been super fit for how many years, whatever. But obviously this is this clinic and the team that I was supposed to birth with, and I didn't want to get on their bad side, right? So I just kept my lips zipped shut. I just didn't say anything negative, and I just said, okay, whatever. But obviously something like this would deflate me, right? Cool. So we finished the checkup. My husband gets the bill or whatever. We hop on the elevator, and I swear, I think the clinic was like on the fourth floor. And so it's a very short ride to get to the first ground floor. But we hop on the elevator, the doors close. My husband just looks at me and he goes, is this stressing you out? And I said, a little bit, but it's okay. It's no big deal. I'll just brush it off. And he goes, no, this is not okay. I see you happy and just glowing every day, except for these checkup days. If you're not happy with this clinic, May, I don't want any stress for you or for the baby. We should change it.
Yeah.
But I said, Anna, I said, yeah, but honey, I know you've paid the down payment for this clinic and they don't give refunds. So you'll, you know, and that was definitely what was on my mind. Yeah. But my husband, he said, I know, it's okay, but we still have to change it if this is stressing you out. And I said, well, I did all of my research and selected this clinic. And if we're not going to birth here, then I think we're going to end up doing it at home. And he just smiled and he could tell that that would make me feel relaxed. That would make me comfortable. And he said, is that what you want? And I said, yeah. And he goes, you know, if that's what you want, then yes, let's do this. But in Japan, 28 weeks is the cutoff line for changing birthing places. I don't know what the regulations are. Yeah, there's a regulation around changing birthing places, again, with the whole like maternal child handbook and how it's associated with each municipality.
Wow.
And my checkup was at 27 weeks. So we just had several days to look for a midwife and sign on with her so that we can birth at home and just switch our entire birth plan, which we did. And so the first midwife that I had worked with down in Fukuoka, she had since retired and she doesn't even live in Tokyo. So I had to look for someone afresh. But I found a lady who was willing to come to my home that I felt comfortable enough working with. So we switched to a home birth plan at like 27 weeks and 5 days. Thanks to my husband, really. Yeah.
Wow. Amazing. Wow.
Yeah.
I find that very strange that there's a cutoff there. Is that some sort of
Like, is it actually illegal to change care providers? Like, is it actually, I mean, that sounds crazy to me. I mean, I don't know any other place in the world that that's a fact. Like, you can change when you're 40 weeks here. Like, most places you can just, you know, you, it's your choice, you know, but for you, like, you can't.
Well, legally. I don't think it's illegal in the sense that there are inevitable cases, right? You might have a big move or have something come up in your life where you must change. Mm-hmm. So there's that. But I guess as I've been hearing on some of these other women's stories too, when the option is presented to you, it's so highly discouraged.
Yeah, right.
That it's almost presented like it's an illegal thing, like you're not supposed to do that, like you can't do that. And I just didn't know any better, right? In my case, for the second birth, at least I was able to make the choice.
Yeah. Right. Maybe they make it really, really hard or something, and it's discouraging. Crazy. Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
Because that's pretty, I mean, you could, that's still a lot of time that you might change your mind. You know, this, you're definitely not close to birth at that point. So that's strange that they have that cut off at 27 weeks.
Yeah, it's so strange on so many levels, because if you were working with a midwife to begin with, then you know that she's going to be on duty when your baby comes. But if you have signed up with a clinic, you don't even know who's on your shift when the day comes, right? You might be working with the same doctor or the same nurse for like 8 months. And then the moment comes and they could be on holiday, or, you know, you might get the night shift person or whatever it is. So it's quite strange on so many levels that there's a lot of inflexibility around something that's not really a working trust relationship anyway.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I'm so happy you found someone. So how did you decide upon this midwife?
Well, after narrowing things down, like the area where I lived and where she would be, and it would need to be close enough so that she could, you know, take her car and come to my place and things like that, there were really only like two or three midwives who were carrying out home births in the Tokyo metropolitan area that made sense for where I lived. So I think I met with, I met with maybe two or three of them, and I just went with the lady that I felt most relaxed with, like most trusty with.
Beautiful. That's the way to go. So did your care change after that? Did she come to your home for checkups? Did you create a relationship?
Yeah, it was really important for me to get to know her, and I wanted her to get to know me, because now we can really start to build a team working towards the birth of the baby. Now no one's going to scrutinize me anymore. That we'd be on the same team. We're not going to be like criticizing each other, that we would be on the same team with the same goal and working together towards it, right? So there was much more of a sense of togetherness. And when she would come to my house for checkups, I would just pull out the mattress like on the living room, and she would examine me or check out the baby. She also, like later on in my pregnancy, helped to prepare my husband, like how he can support me in a way that would be most comfortable for a person in labor. So that was really nice to have. And aside from her, another friend of mine recommended a doula, which is not a common tradition in Japan. So a lot of times in Japan, people haven't even heard of the word doula. But my friend had used this lady who is also an aromatherapist. So I had a few months into my pregnancy where she would come in and she would give me these lovely prenatal massages and stuff too.
That's lovely.
Calling all the women back to the village. Have you felt the aching longing in your blood and bones, sister? The longing to belong to a village of women walking alongside you through life and rites of passages. a sisterhood who nurtures and supports you as you navigate living in harmony with your own and Mother Nature's heartbeat and cycles? Do you know in your deepest heart and soul that we were never supposed to live this independently and isolated to each other as we are in our modern, unnatural world? Then the Maiden Mother and Maga Village is what you have been longing for. In our village, you will find the women who know that they carry magic within their wombs, that know they are powerful, sovereign, and holy by nature. The natural, conscious, open-hearted, and empathic ones from all over the world. Until we live back in the physical village, let us be your village. It's not the same, not nearly as nurturing as a physical village, but it is nourishing. It is supportive and it's available 24/7. It is emotional, spiritual, and mental support, and it's all online, accessible to all. We gather the first Wednesday of every month in a deeply nourishing sharing circle that finishes in a Mama's Q&A full of support and wisdom. And you can now join us for free for a whole month to see if this sisterhood village is for you. You don't have to do motherhood by yourself, dear heart. There is a community of like-minded women ready to receive you in a big warm hug if you let us. Find out more at thenaturalbirthcourse.com.
With home birthing in Tokyo, again, there are certain specific regulations around it. So you can decide to birth at home, and then you have your birth care practitioner, which in my case was my midwife. And then my midwife had an assistant just to support her. But the midwife would have a doctor, a designated doctor, like in a medical facility to work with her. So I would have regular checkups with her. And then every, however, so many weeks, I would also need to go to the medical facility for certain checkups that she wasn't able to do. And then we also had to have a contingency plan in case something went wrong at the time of birth, then which hospital would I be taken to? And all of these things would be mapped out in advance, which was really easy for me because I lived in downtown Tokyo at the time, and three of the best maternal care facilities were like right in my neighborhood. So my contingency plan was phenomenal. But this, because not very many doctors and medical facilities want to work with midwives, for my doctor checkups, I had to travel like, I don't know, maybe it was like 50 minutes away to get to the doctor just to find a person who was like willing to work with my midwife. And then I think it was like, I think I was about 37, 38 weeks. I'm a pretty petite frame person and my baby was a good size. I had this, what I thought at the time was my water breaking. I was on my way to get in the bath and there was a slight kind of pop and a gush sensation. There was definitely some like water fluid leakage. And this was not after the bath, but before the bath. So I thought my water broke and I let my midwife know, but I didn't have any contractions. So we went to have that checked out at her doctor's place. But by then, there were no signs of labor progressing. So they said, just go home and see how you feel. And if labor starts again tomorrow, then, you know, your midwife can assist you type of a thing. But nothing progressed, actually, for another two weeks. So that was like this odd kind of thing. We couldn't really figure out what it was. My midwife thought that it might have been like a slight She called it in Japanese like a kobuhasui, which would signify a water break in the rear side and the back side.
A hind water leak. So that's really curious, I think. So when you went to the doctor, did they actually check for amniotic fluid? Did they do a test to see if it was your waters?
They did.
And did they see that it was?
I don't remember.
Yeah, curious. Because there's so many different ways of handling that around the world, right? And so mostly around the world, it's like, oh, your water's broke. Now you're on the clock. You know, you have to be induced within 18, 24, 48.
Yes.
You know, some places in birth centers and home birth midwives, they say 72, maybe 96 hours. So I'm curious that if it was your waters, because it sounds like it could be a hind water leak, if it was a pop and there was a gush. But you can check for that. You know, there's this easy test to check if it's your amniotic fluid. You can also smell it. It smells like semen. So if you put a pad on and you actually smell it, you can smell the semen. But if it doesn't continue to flow, yeah, it might have just been a little leak that then got sealed by the baby's head.
Yeah, that's what seems to have happened. Mm. There was a little bit of this nervousness around, of course, I wanted a natural birth, so I didn't want to have to be induced or, you know, and then for my son and for my husband, there was so much hype around, we can't wait for the baby to arrive, you know, because it was like a little bit of a tease, you know, like a little water spilling, but another 2 weeks. So the final 2 weeks felt really extended and really long. And I just felt so huge. I felt like my skin was just going to break apart. But yeah, it ended up, I was still just hanging out at home and doing my yoga and just spending another extra lovely 2 weeks. And then it was 40 weeks and 3 days at the nighttime. It was like 10 p.m. I'll never forget because it was Halloween evening. It was October 31st. When contractions started, and I could sense it, that the baby was coming. So I just spent some nice time with my husband. We were lounging on the couch. We took a nice slow walk, and it was kind of funny because everyone in Tokyo, you know, everyone was like dressed in these funky Halloween outfits. And I just had this really big bump, but a real one, you know, not like an outfit. Just like a slow, short walk in the neighborhood. We got home and my husband was like, well, do you want to call the midwife? And I said, yeah, we'll call her, but after a couple more hours with you, because I just wanted to be alone with him. My son was already sleeping. So later on in the evening, we called my midwife and she came. I think she came at like midnight, 12 midnight. She examined me and she said, well, it doesn't look like you're very open. I don't think it's happening today. Shall I go home? And you can see how you feel tomorrow and you can call me again. But I just knew. And also because in my first experience, My first midwife had also told me that I was very tense and I wasn't open, but that if I would, you know, and then I slept and relaxed and it opened very quickly for me. So the second time around, also after my midwife said to me, it doesn't look like it's happening tonight, I said, I know you might be right, but it would make me feel really comfortable if you would just hang out for the night. So why don't you go ahead and, you know, use this blanket and, you know, you can take a snooze on the couch in this room. And I feel like he's coming tonight. She's like, okay.
So can you share with us, like, what is it that you're feeling? Like, how did it start? And did it just start with having like 3 contractions in 10 minutes? Can you talk us through what happened and how you felt that made you feel that way? Or was it just an internal feeling? You want to describe it a bit for us?
Yeah, the contractions were definitely there and I felt like it was steady. But like you say, it was more of this calm knowing, you know, because once I switched to the home birth, I was very focused on this, a sense of togetherness with the baby and also with my midwife and my husband that we were doing this together. And I had practiced my mind to be very attuned to my physical sensations and the sensations of the baby. I don't know, it might be a little weird to say this, but not unlike the day my mother died. My mother was ill for a very long time, and I was at her bed the day that she passed. And by then she had been handicapped and ill for so long that we hadn't spoken or communicated in words for many years. But I knew when she was taking her last breath, because I sensed a knowing. It's not words, but it's almost like a frequency. It's almost like a passage of intention. And I knew that my mom was about to leave her body. And it was a similar kind of knowing that I had with my baby when he was arriving, when he was coming, you know? Also, I guess I skipped the part where when I was preparing for the home birth, I was so focused on repainting the landscape of my mind. Because remember, for the first birth, I had this painful experience of ripping apart from my core. And then the whole phrase that my mom said about how contractions are going to hurt 100 times more before the baby is born. So once I decided on a home birth 8 years later, I knew that I needed to repaint the landscape of my psyche. I watched some of the documentaries about orgasmic births and pain-free births, and I watched whatever footage I can find on YouTube. But at a certain point, I also felt like watching other human women birth felt a little risky for me, because some of them were so beautiful and I could totally vibe with it. But others were like, oh, I thought it was beautiful, but I thought it wasn't going to end that way. You know, so I felt like it was a little too risky for me at this very sensitive phase. So by my third trimester, I got this idea that I would learn from wild animals. Mm-hmm. So every single night I would go on YouTube and mm-hmm. find like wild animal footage of them giving birth. So like one night it would be the gazelle. Another night it was the hippo, zebra, giraffe, like buffalo, you name it. I've seen it. Like I watched them all. And I watched so many of these that I got this feeling. And they had something in common. All of these animals, they would roam and make sure that they're in a safe environment. And they would move in a kind of free manner. And then very often when I had the sound to the footage, they would kind of moan in this like a very open kind of moaning. It was never like an ee kind of screaming. It was a kind of like openness to it. Mm-hmm. I watched so many of these wild animals until one night it just dawned upon me. If they can do it, so can I. You know? Mm-hmm. And that there was no reason that only humans do that screaming thing. And I thought if I would just train my mind to not go there, mm-hmm. but to stay with the kind of openness. Mm-hmm. So I use like guided meditations, and I use like visualizations and a lot of like podcasts and audio to get me in this zone, like an athlete preparing for the Olympics, because I knew that I would just get one go at it.
Yeah.
And what I practiced was my mindset in the face of heightening pressure. So in the former first time birth, as the contractions got stronger and stronger, my resistance, like, also got stronger and stronger, mm-hmm. hence more resistance, hence the tightening and the not opening and not giving way until I let go, until I had nothing left in me anymore, right?
Yes.
So the second time around, 8 years later, I practiced how with each wave that gets stronger and bigger, I would allow more. I would release more. I would open more. I would let go more. And that I would stay present with it the whole way through. I stopped calling contractions contractions because that was my mom's word and I wasn't going to go that route anymore. So I started calling them waves of pressure, because if my mind would recognize them as pressure, then pressure always rises and it always subsides. There's no pressure that just stays. There's always like an ebb and flow to it. So I re-educated, I retrained my mind to see these approaching waves as something that would, that could intensify, but that my allowance, my capacity would also be bigger. So yeah, as I sensed this knowing with my baby, I asked my midwife just to stay in the other room. And I actually told my husband that he can get a few hours of sleep because I'll wake him up when it's time, and that I was okay on my own on the gym ball. He was in the bed and I was still in the bedroom, but I took a couple hours. I had this gym ball and I just wanted to roll and float and just move with the baby. But I must have been making some kind of a moaning noise, because I think it was maybe after, 2 a.m., 2:30, I didn't call her, but my midwife sensed the heightening pressure and she sped my way and she said, wow, you're progressing, the baby's coming. And I actually had tested positive for GBS in one of my final checkups at the doctor. So my midwife had prepared an IV fluid, right, for some antibiotics to protect the baby. And so at like 2:30-ish, she started thinking. It was like in the dark. She just turned on a tiny lamp because I didn't want so much light in my eyes. And she was trying to figure out, well, if I give you the IV now, she was trying to figure out if she should give me the IV now or later. I'm like zoning at this point. And I said, well, how long is it good for? If you give it to me now, how many hours is it good for? And she said, it's good for 7 hours. And I just knew. So I said, oh, go ahead and give it to me now. So she's like, okay. Well, I just knew. So she administered the IV to me. So my arm was on the IV until the fluid was finished. And then at about 4 a.m., with the heightening pressure and with the labor progressing, I was ready to wake my husband up. So I said, hey, will you wake up and support me now? And my husband's a former heavyweight MMA fighter. So he was quite thick bodied. And we had practiced in my third trimester how I would have him sit on the mattress on the floor and lean back against the wall so that I can kind of sit in his lap and lean back. And it would give me like this really lovely human toilet bowl sensation of this openness between my legs. And I loved that because I had all of this thickness and all of this warmth behind me. And that's how a lot of my labor progressed. And I would have almost like given birth there, except my midwife in the final examination, she said, oh, you just have a couple more centimeters to go, just two more to go. So I asked them to prepare the warm tub for me, which my husband and my midwife and I had also spoken about. And so my husband like spick and span cleaned the tub for me and put in this like lukewarm water. And in the final minutes, I moved into the bathtub. And after 6 a.m., I was in the tub and just now really enjoying the free movement of the water and just letting my body move in ways that it wanted to without these preconceived notions of, oh, 80% of women are in this position or this position is better. Like without any of that, just so wild, like the animals that I had watched on YouTube. But after 6 a.m., I had a thought enter my mind. Oh, Isa, my first son, is going to wake up soon because there was an ordinary Wednesday morning and he's going to think that he has school. So it's like 6:15 or something. I'm in the tub just, you know, moving and flowing with the birth. Sure enough, 8-year-old Isa wakes up. I hear his door opening from his bedroom. He trots on down to the living room, kitchen, dining room. Nobody's there. And he finally finds his way to the bathroom, which is a convention of my midwife and my husband and me. And we're like practically having a birthday party in there. So he's like, "Mom, you know, what are you doing, Mom?" And I said, "I'm okay, baby. I'm working on something right now. Would you mind waiting in the living room?" Because I knew that if he were in the room, then my focus would go on him a little. I would worry about him a little. That was one thing. And the other thing was that just on the off chance that something went wrong, I didn't want him to witness anything that might be like traumatizing for him. So I asked him to wait in the living room and he's like, "Okay." And I heard him trotting back down the hall when he stops and he goes, "Mom, do I have to go to school today?" I said, "No, honey, you don't have to go to school today." And he goes, "Okay." And I hear him trotting again. And he stops for a second. And then he hollers again. He goes, "But why?" Mm-hmm. And I said, "Honey, your brother's going to be born today." And shortly after that conversation, with a pop and a gush, my water broke and clear fluid broke into the tub. His head was coming down into my birth canal. And as he was crowning, I had told my midwife in advance that I still had this dream of mine that if I were to have the chance to be able to touch the baby's head with my own hand, as I was not able to do that for my first birth. And for the second birth in my tub, my midwife said, "Hey, son, the baby's crowning. You can reach with your hand now." So I leaned back, I took my left hand, and I felt his head just emerging from between my legs. He had this fluffy hair, this soft virgin, woolly, fluffy hair. It just went this gentle sway, immersed in water. And it just, it just brought me so much joy. But shortly after that, I wanted to switch positions again. So I asked my midwife to please take his head. And I needed to lean back. It wasn't forward for me. I needed to lean back again. And then his shoulders and body followed and he was born. My husband later told me that I was moaning with the birth, that I was whispering and using words like open and release, as well as some of my favorite Indian mantras to guide my mind in that direction, you know, in the opening direction. He also told me later that when he first saw my midwife take the baby underwater, for a second, he thought that she fumbled because the baby had the umbilical cord once around its neck. And my midwife, while he was still immersed in water, she had like spun him around before she lifted him out of the water. So he's like, "I thought she fumbled for a second," but she knew what she was doing.
Wow. And then she put him on your chest.
Yes, she put him on my chest and I held him. And it felt like such a communion of souls. You know, I have no doubt that as a midwife, my midwife had so much training, like medical training and a lot of practice. But of all of the things, of all of her wisdom and her education and her training, I still felt like the thing that she did best was just to hold my hand and to like be really present with me. I felt like she was praying with me, was what it felt like a deep meditation, this presence. So there were very little words involved in those moments, in those last hours, actually. You know, it was very little conversation around, like, you know, should we start the IV now? Or would you like to move to the bathtub? Or, you know, there's very little engagement of thought, just a lot of presence. Mm. Yeah. And I really appreciated that about both my midwife and my husband, that they, as well as for myself too, that we had the capacity to hold that space. Because you hold the space as space. You don't fill it up with thoughts. You don't fill it up with words. You don't have to say stuff. You know, it's the whole point is that you have, it's not even that you created the space, because the space is always there. It's that you're so attuned with the space, and you have allowed your capacity, your of consciousness to go there.
Yeah.
And just, oh, what a beauty it is that life is born that way.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
I love that. And that is truly the most important skill for a birth worker that is so rare to find today, but you find it especially amongst these home birth midwives who practiced
all the time
and learned that less is more, and that in that space, in allowing that space, that is where, you know, sacred, magical mystery of birth happens the best.
Yes, it's holy. And I know that it's the right place for a human being to be.
Yeah.
You know, to be humbled in the capacity, that expansiveness of consciousness, to not close our eyes, but just to be there with it and to allow it, because it's not, you know, it had never been in our control to conceive. You know, we can try, but the conception part is done by nature, you know, and even the birthing part is the force, the life force is the life force. You know, it's not our control. It's not our power. So it was deeply humbling and therefore empowering, you know, ultimately empowering. I have to squeeze in there that for all of, because I know you have a lot of these mentees that work with you, and they are also, some of them are moms too, but they're birth workers. And I just want to say, like on behalf of the women of this planet, thank you, that your work is so important. And in amidst the world, amidst the modern world where we try to fill up our silences with words, we try to measure everything and scrutinize results. We try to understand the not understandable. We try to explain the inexplicable. And, you know, we are like control freaks in a life that is thoroughly uncontrollable. I just want to say that I appreciate you, and I appreciate the work that you offer. It's so easily taken for granted, but it's so true that you are healing women, you are healing birth, and you are healing life one at a time as you make these experiences more available for the woman, you know? Yeah.
Thank you. Very much touches my heart to hear those words spoken from you and being witnessed by you in this work. And thank you for sharing.
Thank you.
So you're there in the bathtub with your baby on your chest. And do you birth your placenta there as well?
I actually moved out of the tub. My husband helped me, and we moved me and the baby, still connected, right, out of the tub. And we had prepared how I would move from the bathroom to the nearest bedroom, which was the master bedroom. And we had prepared a mattress there where I lay down. And I think it was maybe less than 30 minutes, maybe like 20 minutes or something. And the placenta was birthed naturally.
Beautiful. And what did you do with this placenta?
You know, I actually don't remember. I don't remember. I think my midwife had a regulated way that she would take care of it, but I don't remember.
Okay, beautiful. And then What happened? Did you invite your little boy to come into the bathroom?
Yes. Well, we actually had him first come into the bathroom. As soon as the baby was on my chest, we had him come into the bathroom. So he definitely got a good look at the freshness of life and that whole experience. And then we had him move to the living room again, and because we knew that the next part would be bloody, right, with the placenta birthing and stuff. So after that was cleaned up, then he came also into the bedroom. Mm. Yeah, I actually want to add one more thing about the birthing part in the bathtub, because as I was using these words like open and release, I was not sensing any pain. I didn't feel any pain. And this is like a miracle compared to my first birth. And I say that my second birth was almost all pain-free, because it wasn't completely pain-free. What happened was right in those final moments, as the baby's head was, and again, like entering my birth canal, the thought entered my mind, ouch. Mm. And I remember catching the thought, ouch, and I observed, oh, it's been 9 hours since labor started, and I hadn't thought ouch this whole time. So even as the thought ouch entered, I prevented myself from tensing up and cringing with the ouch. And I just said, oh, ouch, release. Mm. Open, let go. So that was the only instant where I felt any moment of ouch, and everything else was pain-free. And it really redefined pain and how we cope with pain in life for me. Mm. Because you think that it's an automated normal reaction to cringe and to tense up in the face of pain. And granted, of course, in many ways it is, but still, ouch is a thought and pain is a sensation. Mm-hmm. So, and pain you can interpret as ouch, but pain, like in the case of birthing, you can interpret as pressure. Mm-hmm. And if you would interpret that as pressure, because if you ask me, did you have a lot of pressure in your body in those hours of labor, I would be like, hell yeah, I had so much pressure, so much intensity, huge waves just getting bigger and bigger and more intense. But my mind was not registering it as pain or painful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I think what you're sharing is such important information. Our minds are so powerful. So powerful in birth. And I've seen women go for days holding their baby in. And I've seen the opposite as well, how women can fully open their bodies through the power of their mind, visualization, power of mantra, sound, how you reframe things in your mind. It is everything. It really is.
And to for you to have the wisdom to guide a woman in that direction too, because a lot of the information out in the world is very biased towards kind of this left-brained interpretation of what something is, as opposed to a more feeling-centered, heart-centered, intuitive knowingness. Mm-hmm. They're both information, and they're both even wisdom, but they're completely different kinds of wisdom to be used at different moments in your life.
Absolutely. And I feel like the world is starting to wake up to realize the wisdom in the feminine, the wisdom in the feeling, in the intuition, in the body wisdom, in us who hold a different kind of wisdom. You know, I have a lot of training, of course, and I've studied a lot, but But I really feel like the more I know that it's being able to hold a mystery that is the biggest part of
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that so much. And I deeply appreciate that. Mm. Mm.
And I think women are starting to resonate more with that, more and more, as they come into their claiming of their feminine bodies and their feminine wisdom and intuition, and claiming birth as their rite of passage. They also seek birth workers that have this knowing, and they move yes. away from what you did, like move away from that which make you feel less of or controlled or not seen and heard, or, you know, fill in the blank.
Yeah, and it's crazy that when I wasn't able to give myself that choice the first time around, it's not because those options weren't available. It's because I wasn't ready for that. Like, my mindset wasn't there yet. And it's not because I was a bad person. It's because I was a more fearful person.
Yeah.
And unknowingly, I had let my mind be more instilled by fear, whether it was my mom talking about how painful contractions were, or it's watching the TV series ER and then, you know, these crazy footages, or any of the information out there, because there's a lot of gunk out there in terms of information, and you let it infiltrate your mind without having the awareness to filter what you want to believe and what you don't, right? And I think that's a lesson that I'm taking for my lifetime, is that now I'm choosing my information, and I'm choosing what I want to believe, and I'm choosing what my choices ultimately are. Like, how do I want to live my life? You know? So
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that so much. Oh, so if you had a first-time mama in front of you right now who's about to have her first baby, and she really wants to have a natural and empowering birth experience, what advice and pearls of wisdom would you give to her?
I want to tell her to trust yourself, that you can trust yourself, that it's okay to trust yourself. And yeah, I think that's the most important thing. The second thing that comes up for me is the sense of safety. It's not what's right or what's wrong, but it's what makes you feel safe, what makes you feel open, what makes you feel joy. Yes. And I think it's so important to be attuned to that, that you are the one that listens first to your sense of safety and joy, and how, and because if you can do that, then you can learn to trust yourself more.
Beautiful. Yes. More self-trust. And as you trust yourself deeper and deeper, the more you also want to take responsibility for your life, not just your birth,
yes.
pregnancy, postpartum, baby, but just life, you know? And I
yes.
feel that is what we are all waking up to more and more, I think, around the world, the understanding.
I wholly agree.
This is
yeah.
our life, and we are the ones. We are the ones that decide. And we need deeper trust in self for that.
Yes, that's beautiful.
Thank you so much, May, for coming on the podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure hearing your birth stories and your amazing wisdom.
Thank you so much for having me. And again, I deeply appreciate you and the work that you do, and your mentees, and all of these birth workers in the world that are really helping to bring back the wisdom and the sense of self-empowerment back to women. So thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening. If you love this podcast, then please consider sharing it, leave a review, or make a contribution on our Patreon page. And if you want to connect on social media, then find the podcast on Instagram as The Natural Birth Podcast. Thank you for listening.